Hello, friends, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, the podcast in which quality has questionable value. Each episode, we read and discuss books or movies, and sometimes the occasional album. Today's subject is the newest novel by Patricia Lockwood, poet and relatively famed author of the memoir, Priest Daddy. But we know her here at Book Spider for her last novel, No One Is Talking About This, one of our favorites, I think. So I was very excited to read this new one, and seeing it came out just a few weeks ago, I leapt at the opportunity to choose it for us. Speaking of them and their sometimes substantive taste, I'm joined by my co-hosts Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. Lockwood's newest novel, called Will There Ever Be Another You, those words taken from her from the Times cover page announcing the cloning of Dolly the Sheep sometime around 2001, I think. I don't actually remember. Anyway, Lockwood is definitely interested in selfhood and what constitutes it. And the question of whether it's possible to ever duplicate a person seems thoroughly debunked here by the incredible prismatic nebula of the inside of Lockwood's mind. This is ostensibly a novel, but so much is aligned with events in her life. She, too, got long COVID that impacted her ability to write and communicate. Her husband, too, nearly died from complications following emergency bowel surgery. In fact, basically, on the book's first page, we learn that the narrator's niece died as an infant, a story beat that is absolutely the crux of Lockwood's other novel. So I looked it up, and her niece did die, being born with Proteus syndrome soon after being born. So we're very close to memoir here. And it seems like perhaps No One Is Talking About This was closer to memoir than I knew at the time when I first read it and when we talked about it. The story here follows a writer whose mind becomes unmoored during the pandemic and who is piecing herself back together. Meanwhile, she's grieving the death of her niece, trying to get back into writing, fretting endlessly about all sorts of things, and working occasionally on a TV series based on her upbringing with a Catholic priest for a father. Yes, Priest Daddy was also option for a TV series. It also seems like some of the events in No One Is Talking About This may be appearing in a movie in this novel, or it's hinted at. The narrator is by turns mystified by her mystifying father, bouncing Gilmore Girls-ily off of her mother and sisters and husband, and stumbling uneasily through C-tier celebrity. I think Lockwood is one of our best writers. I am grateful that this book exists, but I also think we're going to be pretty hard on this book. We'll see. I do think being hard on this book may be very productive. I think actually talking about this book is going to be productive. And I should say at the outset that, you know, I did enjoy spending time with this book, even if I'm going to sound critical. So a few episodes ago, we were discussing Samantha Harvey's Orbital, and we talked about how the beauty of the line-level writing belied a lack of substance, and we used Lockwood's other novel, known as Talking About This, as an example of a book with line-level poetry that nonetheless also commits to a story with substance and themes that are rich and dangerous and worth exploring. Will There Be Another You didn't meet that standard for me. It felt full of surfaces. And it's in a very different tone from Harvey's, but it felt similarly shallow. What did you think? Is this shallow to you, or how would you describe, like, what it is trying to do, if it is trying to do something more than what I got from it?
Well, it has kind of a quality of being worst of both worlds in a certain way between memoir and fiction, I think, right? Where it doesn't have the advantage fiction does of making up interesting stories, because there are no stories being made up. Like, I truly don't understand why this was, you know, like I sent everybody in the podcast a New Yorker article that was published around the same time that is an extended profile of Lockwood. And if you read the profile, it's very clear. If it's not clear from the book itself, it's abundantly clear. This is just a record of things that happened in her life. Like, she doesn't even change names, right? Like, the character is Patricia Lockwood. I think he explicitly referenced as such. So the presentation of it as a novel is very strange to me because it doesn't take advantage of the assets that a novel has, you know? But it also, in like memoir, nonfiction, part of the idea of memoir or nonfiction is reflection, right? You tell some things and then you reflect explicitly on what they mean. You state events and then you analyze those events. And it doesn't really have any kind of, because it's laid out and structured in a more novelistic way, or written in a line level in a, I guess, a more novelistic way, arguably, it doesn't really take advantage of the opportunity for reflection either. So it's, yeah, I don't know, like it just feels like no one is talking about this. I think my sense from, again, from the New Yorker profile, which I guess I don't want to draw on too much because it's extra textual technically, right? But like, my sense from the profile is that, you know, when she started writing No One Is Talking About This, it was meant to just be a whole book of the first half of that book, right? And then her niece happened. And it kind of, there's a way in which the events in her life kind of accidentally imposed what felt like novelistic structure onto just a recounting of day-to-day life. And it's like the same thing doesn't happen here, right? So it does feel kind of like a series of events without much
of
a greater sense.
If someone were going to ask me, you know, Patrick, I've never read a literary novel, and I really want to get into literary fiction. What should I read? I would tell them this novel if I never wanted them to read literary fiction ever again. That's what I would do.
Brutal.
I like what Hans is saying, obviously. Like, he's you know, the idea that it's the worst of both worlds is super good, and I don't necessarily have anything to add to that. We can, you know, maybe I would just say, like, I enjoyed No One Is Talking About This. Like, the first half of the novel, which was more experimental and less narrative, was interesting to me, at least because there was a strong element of satire in, like, making fun of the social media stuff. And so there was at least that driving force to kind of get to the next half where it makes a novelistic turn. And it's interesting to me, Hans, that you say, like, the original novelistic turn wasn't even planned. I like satire, I like social commentary, but, like, that's not going to carry even me through a whole novel. Like, I'm not going to be too interested in a whole novel of, you know, the weird stuff at the beginning of No One Is Talking About This. So it's interesting to me that, like, her outside life imposed to make the novel actually readable and good. And this one just this one is just a bunch of meaningless garbage strung together, you know? Like, that's all I can say.
I'm glad you drew attention to the first half of No One Is Talking About This, Patrick, because even though, like, I really struggled with that. And I think I said in that podcast, like, I was terrified that the whole book was going to be that, because it was really just, like, so fragmented and kind of ADHD jumping from thing to thing to thing to thing.
This novel.
This novel. But I would actually say that the first half of No One Is Talking About This, you mentioned the satire, has real teeth. Like, it has real teeth.
Right.
Like, it's exactly. Really, it's sharp and It's, you know, I think she refers to Trump as the tyrant, correct, in that novel. And there's a political layer that's not, you know, it's not saying something substantive, but it's really tearing into this very strange time that we found ourselves in, that arguably, I don't know, maybe it's stranger now, but the, but it was even worse. But it, you know, I'd say that the first half of No One Is Talking About This still had a quality that this book doesn't have for me.
It's interesting because I think they're trying to do in some ways similar things, in the sense that, like, you know, No One Is Talking About This, the first half is trying successfully to capture the sense of fragmentation that you get from always paying attention to 2017 era Twitter, right? It's trying to write in a way that emulates that sense of fragmentation, disorientation, shallowness. So there's a way in which form is expressing content. And my understanding is that the first half of this book, or, you know, this book overall, is trying to do the same thing with the kind of post-COVID fog, right? Like, it's trying to it's trying to be sort of like scattered and opaque and difficult in a way that mimics the sense of post-COVID brain fog that she was mired in for about a year. But for whatever reason, the device, I think, doesn't work nearly so well here. It doesn't, you know, like, at the very beginning, there's a little bit of a sense of that, but it trails off so quickly. And for being something that ostensibly is a novel about the experience of trying to regain her mind and faculties after that happened, that really only comes in occasionally in a pretty peripheral way. You know, if I hadn't known if I hadn't known going into the book that that was supposed to be the point of it, the book should be legible in a vacuum, right? It should be. And I had wondered what I would make of it if I had gone into it not knowing that it was about post-COVID brain fog. And your reaction to it, I think, is pretty telling, you know, that it's just, it's the ostensible point of it is just so buried because it just doesn't really feel like it was written with any sense of focus or direction, really, right? Like it feels like a lightly revised diary in a way. And sometimes with a work like that, you can kind of accidentally stumble into something that feels like structure and theme. And she is such a charming writer at a sentence level and such an effective writer at a sentence level that it just kind of feels like, you know, the combination of, I think, the quality of her line level writing plus the success of No One Is Talking About This seems to have just kind of created a situation where nobody was going to edit the thing, you know?
Yeah, Hans, you texted us prior to starting this recording, and what you texted was that you found it fairly disappointing in ways which you believe connect to and reveal some of the basic weaknesses of much of modern literary fiction. And that may be the last question that I'm able to, like, ask here, because I think that that's a really toothsome subject. We'll see. But, like, could you expand on that?
Yeah. So the three of us were all in an MFA program from about 2008 to 2010 or 11, give or take, right? And I don't know how much this aligns with your memory of it, but my memory of that time is that there was a lot of discussion about what comes after postmodernism. It felt like, in some ways, we were still living in the shadow of the kind of postmodern era of fiction, but all that stuff was really worn out, right? Metafiction was worn out. Highly experimental fiction was worn out. Fiction kind of abstracted to the point that it just became a big bundle of words. Like, that was worn out, right? And we were all intermittently struggling with the question of what comes after that. And my sense is that what came after it is an era in which a great deal of literary fiction is written and conceived and marketed in a way that involves a very, very, very close alignment between the identity of the author and the events and subjects and characters in the book, right? We're in an era, since about 2014, we've been in an era of fiction which is, I think for a few different reasons, in which the author is so present as to make it a borderline memoir in one way or another, right? I think there's a few different reasons for that. And there's a couple versions of it that you see, roughly speaking, right? I think one version of it is the trend toward what's called autofiction, right? Like Ben Lerner, Leaving the Atoka Station and 1015 by Ben Lerner, both of which are like very readable, enjoyable books that I like a lot, but they're just fundamentally about like Ben Lerner living the life of Ben Lerner, right? And they're I mean, 1015 in particular is basically just about I'm going to pause here. Chris, you're going to have to remember to do an edit here. I hate to be picky, and this is totally my fault. Because I don't have headphones, if you guys are able to kind of avoid like super loud chair squeaks and stuff.
Sorry about that.
No. It's my fault. It's totally my fault. Totally my fault. I planned badly for this. I apologize deeply, but just, I'm so sorry. Okay, resuming. 1015 in particular, right? Like the whole novel is basically just about Ben Lerner having experiences and thinking about how he's going to turn them into his next novel. Rachel Cusk, a lot of it is very similar to that. Autofiction is the term for it, right? There's a great deal of autofiction. There are other authors that I have not personally read, but those are, you know, Cusk and Lerner and Lockwood are the ones that I've encountered. And I think there's also a lot of fiction around this time that is pretty explicitly marketed based on identity, right? And it's a little hard to talk about this without kind of sounding like a reactionary white dude, but like, if we remember, for instance, the novel, I think it was called Small Beauty. Do you guys remember the novel Small Beauty we read for this podcast? So it was about the novel about the Chinese Canadian trans woman.
Oh, okay, yeah, I really liked that one.
I really liked it a lot, but like, I don't remember anything about the plot, really, or the characters, other than Chinese Canadian trans woman, right? Written by a Chinese Canadian trans woman. And again, like, I don't. It was a very good novel. And it's tough, right? Because like, all of the individual works are very good. But they're also, I think, all part of this kind of turn of events where a great deal of literary fiction has become very, very, very close to the subjectivity of the author, right? And you know, I was thinking about this particularly when we read Macbeth for the podcast, right? Because Shakespeare, you know, he's writing characters that are as far from his experience as he could conceive, you know? Kings hundreds of years ago, and women, and Moors, and there's, it was coming to that after having just read at the time some of, you know, the kind of contemporary, like super, super close to the author kind of fiction. It just kind of struck me that there's a way in which many literary fiction authors, I think, have kind of lost the daring to be inventive, right? And you know, part of it, I think, probably has to do with marketing, right? Like in the Twitter era, the persona of the author is a big part of the marketing of a novel in a way that it wouldn't have been before social media. And I think part of it is probably like fair and just concerns about representation, right? That I don't want to dismiss, but I think that, you know,
I don't want to dismiss like a reactionary pig,
right? And like representation is important, but some part of me sometimes just wants to go like, if you want to write a memoir, write a memoir, right? Like if you're, the role of fiction is to empathetically invent. And you know, if you're, if you want to write 8 short stories about being, you know, anybody, maybe just write 8 memoir pieces. And it's particularly puzzling to me because I remember when we were in grad school, and maybe the market has changed in 15 years, right? But when we were in grad school, everybody was talking about how memoir was the hot thing. Creative nonfiction was the hot thing. It was so much easier to sell a piece of creative nonfiction than a fiction. It was so much easier to get attention for it, right? Like, our university was hiring a creative nonfiction professor. And everybody's super excited about that. And it just kind of, even though, like, again, like, all the individual works we're talking about are very good, other than, you know, this, you know, maybe Will There Ever Be Another You? But even though all the individual works are very good, and even though they're, like, valuable questions of identity and representation, also on some level, it kind of pisses me off that, like, memoir and nonfiction and creative nonfiction seem to have won to such an extent that they've kind of like gobbled up a big part of literary fiction, right? And genre fiction, of course, still has, you know, like I don't think that genre fiction suffers from this problem, right? So if you want to read a 16-part series about a goblin seducing elves, like, you know, you don't run into this. But, like, I don't know, I'm a fiction partisan, and, like, the point of fiction is to make shit up. And I am somewhat dismayed by the extent to which a great deal of literary fiction doesn't make shit up. And this book, right, like, Will There Ever Be Another You? You know, like, the nice bougie bookstore in the town that I live, I walked by the window, and there were 8 books in the window, right? And from all sorts of genres and age levels, and you know, the 8 books that get to be in the window, one of them is going to be literary fiction. And it was this novel, which is not fiction, right? And it's like, this shit is zero sum, you know? There's only so many spaces for things to get market attention and be kind of thought about. And it just bugs me on some level that, like what's the bird where, like, the baby slips into the nest, you know? Like, is it the cuckoo? It pisses me off that this book has cuckooed itself into the nest of literary fiction.
I think that's great criticism. Like, I while I was listening to this, I was consistently thinking, like, this is just a memoir. This is just like a lyric memoir, and, you know, what she probably needs to do is just, like, chop it up into little bits and publish them as lyric essays. You know, I'm borrowing from Wittgenstein, who points out that there typically aren't hard boundaries between categories. There are, like, penumbras, shaded areas between categories, but typically you do get to a spot where one thing is definitely one thing and another thing is definitely another, even if, like, some of the area in between is shaded. I guess this is a pretentious way of talking about gray areas. But, like, this book seems definitively to me to be in the nonfiction category. Like, definitively, this is not a novel. This is, you know, and I don't particularly like it as nonfiction either. But if you do break it up into smaller chunks and call them lyric essays, then that lets your reader divorce themselves from the idea that, like, not divorce themselves. That lets the reader kind of embrace the idea that they're meant to, like, form associations and, like, let their thought, like, let the work be a catalyst for diverging lines of thought and reasoning. if that makes sense. It doesn't strike me as a novel.
And it's not, I mean, I think that if it functioned better as a memoir, right, like part of my objection is that it's not a novel, and that's most of the, right. you know, substance of that little rant that I went on. But like, in addition to not being, I mean, you could theoretically make the same criticism of No One Is Talking About This, but it happened to sort itself into a very effective novelistic structure. And the same just, you know, the same does not happen here. I mean, I think even if you want to think of it as lyric essays, it's not really, I don't know, like I read this twice actually, because I really wanted to give it a fair shake. And I did not, on a second reading, I was really working pretty hard to get, to try to like draw real ideas and meaning out of it.
Sure.
And I just couldn't, honestly, I really couldn't, you know?
Who is this? Is this book for a particular audience? And maybe you guys could, you know, weigh in and say that like authors shouldn't be thinking about a particular audience when they're writing. That writing is a form of expression and connection that is pure, and you know, a book will find its audience. But I really couldn't figure out, you know, because of that really like messy gray area in which this book really insists itself, like it could be much more easily marketed as a memoir. Why is there a reason for it to market itself this way, to categorize itself this way?
As far as I know, in creative nonfiction, and maybe to a lesser extent in poetry, you don't actually get to publish a memoir unless the thing that you're publishing, that you're writing about, is novel in some way. Like, you know, you had this crazy experience that not many people have. And so you get to write a memoir about it, right? I'm trying to think of an example. Like, I guess Homage to Catalonia is a pretty good example. Like, it's not, I guess, it's close to memoir, but it's also super close to personal journalism. But, you know, like, this is an experience of somebody who fought in a war, right? Like, that is going to sell as a memoir. Whereas, you know, if you just go to a publisher and like, yeah, this is my memoir of living in Cincinnati and elsewhere, I talk about Price Hill Chili, you know, like, you know, no publisher is going to be interested in that.
But I'll say they would be, because she's Patricia Lockwood. Like, I think they would. Yeah, because it's not,
that's fair,
an person with long COVID. It's, oh, right. I'm, you know, one of the most celebrated writers today, and I got aphasic and like couldn't speak or think or communicate, right? And this is my memoir about that.
I wonder if part of the concern is that treating it as a memoir would make it more obligated to be sculpted into something a little bit more of a polemic or essayistic, or, I mean, because like, you know, she did have a novel experience. She had a new disease that had arisen for the first time in the world and was rendered severely disabled in ways that medical science could not address or experience or necessarily even believe, right? Like, that's an interesting thing. And granted, lots of people lots of people had disability from long COVID. But I mean, I think if you too explicitly make it a memoir about that, then like, for one thing, you would have to edit it to focus much more on that ostensible focus, right?
Right. You don't just get to say whatever bullshit comes to your mind.
And probably you would have to kind of, I mean, there's a very, like, this raises interesting questions about, for instance, as society, how do we handle disabled individuals, right? Like, this is someone who lost her ability to gain a livelihood for a year. And And but she lost it in a very kind of like confusing way that maybe not everybody would even find credible. I'll admit, in the darkest parts of my heart, some deep, deep down part of me was like, you know, you're kind of crazy. And you were kind of crazy before you got long COVID. And, you know, like, and to some extent, that's probably like, obviously that's unfair, right? But like a memoir might be more strongly called upon to have rebutted that perception in a meaningful way, right?
Right.
It would be more intended to be a persuasive work. And it doesn't seem like she wanted to write that, which, fair enough, you know. But.
Don't write this, then. You don't want to, if you don't want to write a memoir, don't write this instead, please.
Yeah, I have this thought that there is, I don't know if it's a new market, but it feels like, it feels like this book, I don't know, this sounds cynical, but there is a way in which the book is described, you know, in the jacket or just like in press about a woman who, develops a mysterious illness and is, kind of losing her mind while going through grief. It makes me think, because I don't really think the book is that, that there's a tension to make this book about something that, sort of pushes it in the direction of fiction. When, you know, like really like it's a journal and it's not easily assemblable into like one like thing. But, you know, if it were to do something like, you know, what DeLillo does and sort of start with that as a subject and then use that as a platform for interrogating really rich themes, then, you know, that would be one thing. It feels a bit like it feels to me like that tension comes from how do we market this? How do we package this? Because I really do wonder what this looked like, if it's been edited at all, you know, before the publishers got a hold of it, you know, like, is this sort of like, kind of a collection of B-sides that kind of came together to sort of make up for, you know, these last few years that Patricia Lockwood has, not been putting a lot out because, you know, she couldn't. And this is basically her getting back into form. Like, I don't mean for that to sound, dismissive of, you know, people have a right to put out like art and work that is of varying quality and is trying to do different things. And so like, that's not me attacking that. It just feels a bit like this book doesn't have a lot going for it in any one direction. And, selling it as something that is about something, as a kind of a fictional object, as I think that that's my cynical take on it. It's like it really, because so much extra textual information is needed to even sort of like figure out what is actually going on. I'm not even sure that COVID is indicated as her illness in the book. Hans, you read it twice. I don't know if I missed that. Did she mention COVID?
You kind of have to read between the lines.
Yeah. Yeah. All that to say, I think she's one of our great writers. I hope she's writing herself back into form. I would like to see the teeth of the first half of no one is talking about this. Just that would be more more caloric than will there ever be another you? And yeah, I don't know. Like, I could continue to ask questions, but I feel like we've, you know, I don't know if I don't know what to mine more for. I have other questions, but
what else is there to say?
What else to say?
Yeah,
Chris, did you read Priest Daddy?
No, I never did.
I read about the first third of it. Yeah. It's funny. Like I had a 2 week period, and I was worried actually that this kind of I was worried that this had corrupted my perception, right? I had a 2 week period where I had to read four novels. I had to read this for the podcast. And then I decided I also wanted to read The Mind Reels by Freddie DeBoer to see if I wanted to pick it for the podcast, which I would have had to do by today. And then I also had to read, I had to finish Absolution by Jeff Vandermeer so that I could have it cleared out so I could read the other stuff I had to read. And then I decided, I assumed Priest Daddy would be short because all of Lockwood's books are short. So I also bought Priest Daddy, and I basically set myself the task of reading Absolution, Priest Daddy, The Mind Reels, and this in 2 weeks. And of course, you know, when you take something that is supposed to be a pleasure and an indulgence and you turn it into a chore, you somewhat negatively impact your relationship to it. And I didn't love any of those four books, and I was worried that I had corrupted my experience by turning it into a chore. But I only got about a third of the way through Priest Daddy. And I wanted to read Priest Daddy because I was interested in trying to figure out what distinguished things that are explicitly marketed as memoir from things that are marketed as fiction by the same author, right? And I mean, you know, if you read Priest Daddy, like if there was any doubt, it's all the same people, it's all the same everything, right? The only difference is time and style. So it's just, I know that because Chris, you're such an enthusiast of her work, I was curious if you had read Priest Daddy and had any thoughts about how it compared to this.
No, I'm terrible about following up and continuing to read people that I like. I really liked her article about meeting the Pope. I thought that was pretty great. That came out like a couple years ago. And I really loved No One Is Talking About This. And apart from that, I don't know that I've read very much. So, you know, maybe it's silly of me to say, you know, that she's one of our great writers. I just loved No One Is Talking About This, maybe more than anything else I've read in the last 10 years. Yeah. I think it's just one of the great books. And I'm not super drawn to memoir. I think like memoirs, I end up skipping through. I just kind of, I'll start with the full intention of like really like digging down into them, but I'm trying to remember the last memoir that I've read that I didn't end up just kind of going through after I kind of get the silhouette of what they're trying to get at for their own interiority. I just want to skip through and actually like it's almost like, you know, kind of like following the plot, you know, of something and not really caring about the texture as much. For whatever reason, I just don't end up caring as much about the texture of memoirs. And I really love her writing style, even though I really felt, I didn't really say this explicitly, No One Is Talking About This has an incredible like acerbic tone, and that returns here, but it almost, it, like I mentioned Gilmore Girls, there's a little bit more of a kind of bubblegum lightness to Will There Ever Be Another You that I didn't like as much. And so I love her line level writings, which maybe that's what carries me through a memoir of hers. But yeah, I'm not very much of a memoir reader, and that's probably why I haven't picked up Priest Daddy.
The thing that struck me about Priest Daddy, which is older than the two novels, even though they're kind of a trilogy in a way, the thing that struck me about Priest Daddy is that she's become a much more economical writer. That, you know, Priest Daddy, it's very clever. It has that kind of, what you called, not unfairly, that kind of Gilmore Girls cleverness. It has that, but I think it's like 400 pages, and it feels like if she had written it now, it would be 200 pages. It just has a lot more words than, and you know, again, word by word, they're all very entertaining. But and I actually mean this, and I know that this sounds like one more kind of bitchy thing. I actually mean this in a positive way, right? Like, I appreciate how much more economical she's gotten, and how, you know, in Will There Ever Be Another You, you know, a lot of the sentences almost have kind of like a puzzle quality, right? Where you have to read them a couple times to like pull the idea out. And I don't think that that's I like that as a technique, right? Because like, it's there, it just takes a little bit of slowness and chewing. And I do appreciate that. And it's something that she's developed that's like kind of the flip side of that sense of economy. And I do like that, you know, I find that appealing.
Well, I think that's it. I think if you are interested in Patricia Lockwood, or if you are interested in the rainbow lit cat on the cover of her book, as you pass it in a bookstore window, just go inside. Don't grab this book, and grab No One Is Talking About This, which is, you know,
better.
It's better. It's an incredible book.
Way better.
And I will as soon as she writes another book, I will buy it right away, because I think she has incredible talent, and I'm just like super excited to see what she does next. I just hope that it has more focus than this one.
I'm going to do something now that I did not do because I wanted us to all kind of, I wanted to have authentic responses here. I'm going to go read some reviews of this because I'm curious how it's being treated by critics. I wonder if there's a little bit of like a emperor's clothes thing, right? Where like people, because she is kind of a beloved figure, and because, right, like there's a certain kind of politics here where like this is a long COVID book, and you know, you don't want to kind of call the authenticity and legitimacy of long COVID into question in the public square. I wonder how this is being, I'm curious how this is being treated in reviews.
Yeah, I'd be curious too. I mentioned in my question, I didn't say this when I asked that question, but that this book felt a bit like almost like a Rorschach. Like I could imagine a political Rorschach, I should say. And I'm just saying this because you mentioned the politics. Like there's a way in which, you know, like chronic illness and the kind of twee, the liberal, specifically liberal twee of the novel. And the, I don't know, the things that she finds herself fretting about, I found myself, you know, thinking someone oriented, you know, on the someone conservative reading this would point to this novel and say, this is an example of what the liberal arts education is doing to the next generation of people. And And I can see it too being something that is, you know, a particular audience who really champions expression and undiluted sort of rights to complain about or to be whatever you want to be, kind of really enjoying the just like moment to moment like nature of this book. And I think that that generation, like when I think about that generation, this occurred to me earlier, Hans, when you mentioned, you know, like sort of books as a connection to the author rather than as an object unto themselves. It feels like something that is like in resonance with our sort of influencer era, or Twitch streaming era of entertainment and media, where actually, you know, you might not buy of the video game. You might actually, you know, spend hours and hours watching other, you know, or specific people play the video game. And it's, you know, a way to connect with that person. And, you know, there's no way to separate. There's less of an interest in, and even there's a market to be found in not separating the product from the person. And really, actually, it's about hanging out with people. And this feels like a hang, right? This feels like you're hanging out with Patricia Lockwood. And, you know, I probably, you know, it sounds like maybe I liked this book better than both of you guys, even if I didn't like it very much and I was pretty disappointed by it, because I liked like hanging out with Patricia Lockwood. But I also, like you said, Hans, I don't really read a novel to hang out with the author. I just don't, you know? So like, I don't know. There is a way in which I feel, I guess I feel like I hope that this isn't a trend for Patricia Lockwood, even if I can see it as representative of a trend in, you know, how people, you know, make money, making things, making art and putting their voice out there. It's these days, it's a lot about it's less about the product itself and more about the presence of the author or the creator behind the product. And I don't like that.
And I think to some extent, like all this stuff has always been to some extent true, right? You know, like the last older book I was really moved by was Penin by Vladimir Nabokov. And hey, it's a novel about a professor who is a Russian exile, written by a professor who is a Russian exile. So, haha, the thing that I've been bitching about is how it's always been, right? But I mean, like, Penin is clearly a different person than Vladimir Nabokov, right? You know, Hemingway wrote a bunch of novels about war, and, you know, he had some of those experiences, right? So it's not as though any of this is entirely new, right? I think what's shifted is a question of focus. What's shifted is a question of what is given priority and what isn't, you know?
All right. Thank you so much for spending the time with us and listening to us talk about Will There Ever Be Another You by Patricia Lockwood. What is our next novel, guys? Or next novel? Next subject?
So, it will not be a novel. I'm going to send you guys two installments of email newsletters. And I'll send them to you. Two installments of email newsletters. I'm not going to say anything else. I'm just going to say two installments of email newsletters. One of them is The Law That Can Be Spoken Is Not the True Law by Sam Chris. One of them is Lonely Island Adventures by Naomi Kanakia, which is to say that is the subject line of the email that I received. That's all I'm going to say. So I'm going to forward you those at some point in the next couple days.
I'm so excited. I'm delighted by this.
Do either of you do either of you read Sam Chris? Did that ring a bell? What I just said?
No, not okay. For me.
No,
I think you'll find it interesting.
All right,
awesome. All right. Well, with that mysterious teaser, tune back in next episode for discussing the strange emails that Hans is going to send us. Thanks, guys. This was fun.
All right. Peace out, dudes.